Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Next week, State College will host the 18th National Autism Conference. Today on Take Note, we'll talk with Dr. Daniel Noderman about the current state of autism research. Dr. Noderman has just stepped down from the position of Vice Dean for Research and Graduate Studies and Professor of Pediatrics and Biochemistry at Penn State College of Medicine. He's going to Princeton University, where he'll continue his research into the causes of autism. WPSU's Emily Reddy talked with Dr. Noderman about where we are in our understanding of autism.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Dr. Noderman.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
There have been many studies over the past 15 years or so that say there's no link between vaccinations and autism. A recent report pooled and evaluated multiple studies, so the results are based on nearly 1.5 million children. It found no link. So at this point, is there any uncertainty for you that there is no link between vaccinations and autism?
No, I think that it's been established as well as any scientific fact can be established. And I think that for the purposes of counseling patients, advising families, public policy, there's sufficient evidence to conclude that there is not a link of any type between vaccine administration and autism or autism spectrum disorders.
Let's look at the history of the claim that immunizations cause autism. In 1998, Andrew Wakefield published a study that claimed a link, but that study was later found to be a fabrication.
Yes, the study in question had a very large impact. It was concerned with the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, and it purported to show vaccine particles in children with autism spectrum disorders. But as you mentioned, later it became clear that much of the evidence had been either fabricated or misrepresented or misinterpreted. Most of the other authors ultimately disclaimed their confidence in the article, and ultimately the publisher of the journal withdrew the article.
And Wakefield was even stripped of his medical license.
Correct. That's right.
Why do you think, after this study has been discredited so many times, people still cling to its findings?
Well, I think the most significant reason is that the timing of vaccinations and the time at which autism spectrum disorders become clinically manifest, at which parents begin to get very concerned because of behavioral differences, and failure to begin to speak, these time periods overlap. It's also the case that vaccines do have some side effects very infrequently, minor, certainly more minor than the diseases they're preventing. And so this has led to linking the two together. Parents are obviously very concerned about the welfare and the health of their children. We see lots of children with autism because it's a prevalent problem. We don't see much measles. We don't see much rubella. We don't see much pertussis. We don't see polio. So it's out of people's sight. What people forget, of course, is that the reason we don't see these diseases much anymore is because of these vaccines. And, of course, the consequence of not being vaccinated has been an increase in some of these diseases.
Can you talk a little bit about that, about how these diseases are showing up again? Some of the facts are the percentage of parents who delayed or refused vaccinations rose from 22% in 2003 to nearly 40% in 2008. I mean, what are the disease implications we're seeing because of that?
So when a person is vaccinated, there are two effects, a direct effect and an indirect effect. And the direct effect is on the person. With a very high probability of success, modern vaccines will prevent the target disease. So a person properly vaccinated and then revaccinated at the appropriate time with measles will not contract measles even if exposed. A person vaccinated against polio will not contract polio, and so on. And the indirect effect is the effect of herd immunity. When a population of people is immunized to the extent that 80% or more of the people are immune to the disorder, it becomes very hard for the virus to spread among the population, even to people who are still susceptible. And as you fall below 80%, you begin to get spread, so that if somebody, for example, goes to the Philippines now and has not been immunized and comes back to Harrisburg, if there's a low level of population immunity to measles, there's a better probability of transmitting the disease to other people and among other people. So what's happened is that in certain communities, not generally across the United States, yes, but if you isolate certain communities, the Amish are one such community, for example, there are vaccine rates that are falling well under 80%. And so that when an outside person comes into that community or a member of the community travels to an area where one of these diseases is prevalent or endemic, they can bring the disease back and it can spread like wildfire in the population. And so, in fact, we're seeing the resurgence of pertussis spread in the U.S. and measles spread in the U.S., in part because of this problem.
The CDC says measles cases are at a 20-year high, 288 cases this year as of May 23rd.
That's correct. CDC follows this very carefully, and there's a great deal of alarm about measles. And in part, these increases are due both to a fall off in vaccine rates and to epidemics in foreign countries that are being brought back by travelers. I mentioned the Philippines, and that's one place where there's a fair amount of measles right now.
When I was setting up this interview, I was told it's hard to find someone willing to be interviewed about vaccines and autism because of the complaints that they get afterward. Is that something you worry about when you talk about this issue, that you're going to hear about it?
Well, no, I'm a pediatrician, so it's my responsibility to talk about it. I talk about it at a community level, and I talk about it with my colleagues, and I talk about it publicly when I'm asked to. The fact that I talk about it doesn't mean that I don't understand the concerns that parents have and the fears and worries that motivate them. But as the paper you mentioned earlier shows, the meta review shows, a clear analysis of the data demonstrates without any reasonable medical doubt that there is not a link between vaccines and autism. But I do know, having seen patients with measles and pertussis, diphtheria, and poliomyelitis, that these are awful diseases. They're not minor diseases just because they're the common childhood diseases. And they can make people very sick and actually affect the rest of their lives and sometimes kill them.
What do you tell those parents who are searching for a reason that their child has autism?
Well, I believe that the cause of autism is mainly a genetic cause. It's an area of research that I participate in. Many people have participated in this. There is unequivocal evidence of a link between certain mutations, some of which are inherited, some of which are new in the person, and the development of an autistic spectrum disorder. Now, it might be that different mutations, there are probably over 100 already, that different mutations have different penetrance, as the geneticists call it. And one mutation might be so bad that even without any environmental exposure, the child is destined to develop autism. But it may be that other mutations are less penetrant. And that means that a combination of certain environmental factors, which we don't really understand yet, and genetic factors produces the autistic phenotype. So I think that because we know and are beginning to understand what causes autism at the genetic level and also how it affects brain structure, it's clearly not compatible with a vaccine-related cause.
You've worked to identify autism susceptibility genes in families. For example, in identical twin studies, if one twin is affected, there's up to a 90% chance that the other twin will be affected. That genetic factor that you're talking about, it seems huge.
Yeah, that's called the heritability. And the number you cite is correct, whereas the chance of dizygotic twins both having autism is basically the same as the chance of any two siblings having autism.
And dizygotic, fraternal twins?
Correct. That's right. And in fact, that's what's motivated one of the research projects that my lab is involved in with people at the University Park campus of Penn State. We've been able to collect seven families with monozygotic twins and about the same number of families with dizygotic, so identical versus fraternal twins. And we've done complete genome sequencing using equipment both at University Park and at Hershey, and have developed complete genome sequences of the children with autism, their typically developing sibling sometimes, or both children might have autism, the parents and other brothers and sisters, to try to define the genetics of autism a little bit better.
On the environmental side, a study at UC Davis found that mothers living within a mile of fields where pesticides were applied were at a 60% higher risk of having a child on the autism spectrum. What do we know about the links between chemicals and the development of autism?
So, in my opinion, it's likely that there will be a link, such as the one you mentioned, established, because we know that many of these chemicals and other environmental influences cause DNA damage to the spermatozoa or the eggs. For example, we know that older parents have a greater chance of having a child on the autistic spectrum than younger parents, and that's explained by the fact that there's a slow accumulation of DNA damage in the ovum or in the sperm as a person ages, that the probability that some event has occurred increases with age. And just as age can produce these DNA changes, so could an environmental toxin, such as a pesticide, exposure to chemotherapy, exposure to other forms of radiation. It wouldn't be a surprise at all.
If there is a genetic link, does that suggest that some kind of gene therapy maybe could be used for someone who's autistic?
Well, I think that that's quite far into the future, because the kinds of cells that are involved in autism, of course, are brain cells, and brain cells reproduce very slowly, if at all. Only some populations do. So it would be very difficult to fix the existing damage. However, the insights we gain from genetics inform us about the mechanism of the disorder. So, for example, it may be that a certain mutation affects how two neurons communicate across the synapse. And it might be possible to develop chemicals, drugs that we can administer to people that would counteract those abnormalities. So, for example, if we were to find that in certain cases of autism related to a certain gene, there are abnormalities in the neurotransmitters that are producing the or making the spectrum phenotype worse, we might be able to tailor-make drugs to counteract that.
Is that what they call personalized medicine?
That would be a personalized approach, personalized medicine means tailoring therapy to the individual person. It's mainly applied now to cancer, where specific chemotherapy, not really chemotherapy, but specific biological or immunological therapy is targeted based on one's assessment of the specific mutations in that person's tumor. Hopefully, we hope to be able to use this personalized approach for many diseases and possibly autism. I think that the most important outcome of the research now for, let's say, the next decade will be to enable parents to make informed decisions about the chance that they might have a child with autism, as we do for other genetically transmitted diseases. And it will help us better understand the overall mechanisms of autism. It's possible in the fairly near future that we could detect mutations in autism susceptibility genes well before a month of gestational age by drawing some blood from the mother, in the same way we can detect Down syndrome that way now. And once we're able to do that, then we might be able to prevent some cases or modify some cases of autism either through gene therapy or administration of drugs.
So you might be able to tell a mother there's a such and such percent chance that your child will have autism?
Yes, based on intrapartum screening in the same way we do for Down syndrome or central nervous system defects, neural tube defects.
If you're just tuning in to Take Note, we're talking with Dr. Daniel Noderman about the current state of autism research. Dr. Noderman studies the causes of autism.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that 1 in 68 children fall somewhere on the autism spectrum. Just a couple of years ago, the number was 1 in 88. A few years before that, it was 1 in 150. I mean, is autism becoming more prevalent, or does a growing awareness mean it's more likely to be detected?
So this is a frequently asked question, and I should just add to a previous answer I gave you, one of the other reasons that people worry about vaccines and autism, even though it's been repeatedly disproved, is that the apparent incidence of autism increased at about the same time that vaccine administration frequency increased as more and more vaccines came on board. So people put that together too. To answer the question about prevalence now, it's highly likely that the increase in prevalence is apparent and not real. We have changed the diagnostic criteria several times, each one being a bit broader. We have made much more strenuous efforts to identify children with autism earlier and earlier. And of course, that will increase the prevalence because we're probably missing many cases. And we've become much more precise in diagnosis. So whereas, you know, 40 or 50 years ago, we would talk about a child as being mentally retarded or somehow needing special education, now we provide them with a specific diagnosis, often of autism. That's called diagnostic substitution. So the ascertainment bias implicit in looking for more cases, the change in diagnostic criteria, which leads to diagnostic substitution, in my opinion, and I think in most people's opinion, lies at the root of the increase in prevalence.
That CDC report on prevalence also found that 1 in every 175 children in Alabama and 1 in every 45 children in New Jersey is identified on the autism spectrum disorder. So what you're saying doesn't mean, you know, if you live in New Jersey, you should move to Alabama.
No, in fact, people from Alabama move to New Jersey once they have a child who carries the diagnosis because the services are so good. And that's part of the reason for the geographic disparity, is that some states offer more complete services for children with autism, and parents move to the state, those states. They become very much aware of that. And secondly, that in states like New Jersey, there are really strenuous efforts to identify children early at the schools, at the pediatrician's office, in daycare. And that leads to a higher prevalence.
Penn State is about to have its 18th autism conference. Its first conference was in 1998. 100 people were expected and 300 showed up. Now, thousands of educators, therapists, and parents come together for this event. How great does this show that the need is for reliable information, and how difficult is that to find today?
So I think that if you're a professional, or you're an educated healthcare consumer, especially if you're a parent who's concerned about autism, the information is available through many sources, obviously chiefly through the internet now. But there's also a lot of misinformation, and the responsibility of people like myself who are health pediatric professionals and of educators is to help parents and the public filter that information so that the reliable information comes to the top and the innuendo and the unsupported pseudoscientific allegations are filtered out. For the person who is worried that the child may have autism, for the person who wants to think about the things we've been talking about, as people should, They really do need the help and guidance, I believe, of a trusted professional. They can become terribly confused by some of the unsupported claims that are made on the internet by some celebrities and by people who have an agenda. So I would say that at the level of the parent and the public, you need to find somebody that you can identify as a trusted partner in sharing this information.
In addition to vaccines, is there anything else that we know does not cause autism? Things that, you know, maybe were suspected but now have been ruled out?
Well, it's just parenthetically, it's worth mentioning because it's described in this article. They also not only looked at the vaccine per se, but some of the components of the vaccines, which were blamed for causing autism, such as thimerosal or mercury that's added in small amounts, used to be added in small amounts, to the vaccines as a preservative. When people became concerned about this, the pediatric formulations of these vaccines are now sold without thimerosal or mercury, for sure. Yet rates of autism have not decreased. So these additives turned out not to be responsible for spectrum disorders. There are many studies that look for links between some environmental event and autism. So I mentioned the parent's age. That certainly is related. But parents' drinking habits have been looked at, whether they smoke or not, other medications that they take, and other genetic disorders such as Down syndrome have all been linked in one way or another, some reliably, some not, to autism. Many children with Down syndrome also have an autistic spectrum disorder. And it's becoming apparent that that's really not unusual at all.
Which of those have been reliably linked to autism?
Well, as I mentioned, age. I mentioned Down syndrome.
And the smoking and drinking?
Not really. Drinking is certainly linked to other disorders that are associated with developmental delay, for example, the fetal alcohol syndrome. But it's not specifically linked to autism per se, although children with fetal alcohol syndrome can have some autistic features. Some people have linked influenza in the mother while she was pregnant to later autism in the child. This is very much an area of study. And other infections as well.
So is there anything we know of that can be done to decrease the risk of autism?
Yes. So have children earlier rather than later. And although that's not possible for many people. And of course, women should be immunized against influenza during pregnancy, if necessary, for the strain that's prevalent in the particular year. And that would certainly decrease autism related to influenza infection, if in fact that's a link. I'm not sure that's true yet.
Overall, where are we in our understanding of what causes autism?
Well, we understand that there's a genetic cause and there may be environmental modifications. We know a lot about the genetic causes that people have discovered. We're just beginning to understand, really at the very beginning of understanding, how these genetic aberrations affect the organization of the neurons in the brain and how that abnormal organization of these neurons and brain connections ultimately produces the autistic phenotype. I would say in understanding the genetics, we're probably 50% of the way there. I would say in understanding the connection between the genetics and the actual structure and function of the neurons, we're probably 5% of the way there.
And what's the most important, as far as you're concerned, area where research is being done on autism?
Well, they're all important. It's hard to answer that question because one strand of research never stands on its own. And so I think that it's increasingly important to use techniques such as systems biology, which tends to look at the large at the broad interactions between components of the central nervous system to try to understand the links between genetics, cellular structure, cellular function, connections between neurons. I think all of those areas are important. So research using models, right? Other animals that can be manipulated genetically and phenotypically, that research is very important. Research at the biochemical level, trying to understand how to modify or reproduce the abnormalities in electrical signaling, which probably are involved in autism. All this is very important. And of course, we shouldn't neglect the kind of work that educators and psychologists do in defining more effective ways to treat children with autism through educational and behavioral efforts.
What do you think is the most important thing for people to know, maybe parents to know, about autism?
So I think that it's important for parents to know that most children don't have autism, that the prevalence rates established by the CDC do not indicate a growing epidemic, for example. I don't believe that autism should be considered to be an epidemic. Autism is likely to have been present in humankind for hundreds and thousands of years, hundreds to thousands of years, and it's unlikely that the prevalence is sharply increasing. So people should look forward to their, you know, having children with the joyous expectation they always have had. They should not be overly anxious, but when their children are you know, in the second half of the first year of life into the second year of life, they should make sure that the children are following the normal developmental sequence. There's a lot of material available for parents in screening their children. Pediatricians have now been asked by our academy to routinely screen children for autism because it's almost certainly the case that early detection, particularly of the milder cases, and early aggressive intervention can really improve the outcome of this. And so that's why it's very important to screen children, for parents to be alert to problems, particularly with speech, problems with play with other children or attentiveness to the parent, and insisting if there's concern that the child be properly evaluated.
Thank you for talking with us, Dr. Noderman.
Okay, you're welcome. It was very good to have the opportunity to speak with you about this.
WPSU's Emily Reddy talked with Dr. Daniel Noderman about autism in the run-up to next week's National Autism Conference in State College. Dr. Noderman has just left the position of Vice Dean for Research and Graduate Studies and Professor of Pediatrics and Biochemistry at Penn State College of Medicine. He's returning to research and teaching full-time at Princeton University. For WPSU's Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia.